On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the Double X Gab Fest for Thursday, August 23rd, the P90X edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of Double X here at the Washington, D.C. studio. I am joined in New York by Allison Benedict, the other editor of Double X. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
And also Noreen Malone of The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
Our three topics today are, first, we're going to talk about the ignorant things that Representative Todd Akin said and why they matter. And second, we're going to talk about the hot or not debate about Paul Ryan. And thirdly, we're going to talk about Augusta and whether the two women who were recently offered membership should have taken it. So, just to recap what happened, on a TV interview recently, Representative Todd Akin, who's a Republican from Missouri, was talking about rape exceptions with abortion. And he basically said, if it's legitimate rape — that was his first mistake, calling it legitimate rape — then, and now here comes his second mistake, then the female body has ways to try and shut that whole thing down. So what do you guys think he meant when he said the female body has ways to try and shut that whole thing down?
So it turns out that Akin's an acolyte of this guy, Dr. John C. Wilkie, who is sort of a, you know, crackpot of a doctor who was the president of the National Rights to Life Committee. And he sort of spread the myth that this was a thing. The New York Times quoted him saying, this is Wilkie, this is a traumatic thing. She's, shall we say, she's uptight. She's frightened tight and so on. And sperm, if deposited in her vagina, are less likely to be able to fertilize. The tubes are spastic.
So I love this theory. Like, I am also really uptight and yet incredibly fertile.
The tubes are spastic. I don't even know what that means, but
this does not give it any credence whatsoever, or his belief in it any credence. But Todd Akin is not the only person who believes this.
Not by
a
long
shot. Which makes it much scarier. He didn't misspeak. It wasn't
Although
a gaff.
He's now saying he did.
He is saying yeah. that, but I am
right.
not
of
buying
course
that.
Not. Of course not.
Yeah.
Of course not.
We'll get into more of that later, because that taps into the question of what legitimate rape is and what's consensual rape, which is another term that conservatives use. But before we completely shut that one down, is there any legitimate biological research about stress and the ability to get pregnant? Like, in pregnancy books, they're always telling you, you know, relax, don't be stressed out. When you're stressed out, it's really hard to get pregnant. I mean, that's like completely standard in the how to get pregnant literature. And so is there any, you know, biological support for this? It's completely 100% crackpot crazy. Obviously, you can get pregnant if you're stressed out or raped, because many, many thousands of people have.
I don't know all the research, but I think that being a stressed out person, having, like, you know, stress in your life that leads to heart disease, or, you know, stress has, like, many medical implications, but I don't think that that's not the same thing as, like, actually, you know, stopping the sperm from fertilizing.
Well, and stress, like, is different from trauma.
Now, I guess this leads us to the question of why conservatives play around with the term rape, right? Because they want it to be as limited as possible. Like, it's become socially unacceptable to be a conservative who doesn't believe in the rape exception, or at least they're ambivalent.
No, that's not true, actually. What was so socially unacceptable about what Todd Akin said was the part about, you know, the body will shut it down. But many Republicans do not believe in rape exceptions. It is not unacceptable. It's part of their platform.
Erin Carmone at Salon had actually a really good piece on this. She said, I think it's more intellectually honest for people who are pro-life to not believe in a rape exception, because it's sort of saying, it's like either you believe in a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy or you don't, you know?
And either you believe that this thing inside at any stage is a person,
right,
and then killing it is murder, or you don't.
Right.
I agree with that.
I mean, totally agree with that. And the rape exception, like, which you're seeing in the Hyde Amendment already, in order to get federal funding for abortions, it only applies for cases of rape and incest. That just opens up such a can of worms. And then we're back to what is legitimate rape and what is not. And then, you know, the question of proving rape is always a really tough one. And it just seems like a headache that is not what we need added to this debate at all.
And legitimate rape is just another code word for forcible rape, which is frequently used in conservative circles. So the outrage to Aiken seems much more tied to A, his like embarrassing ignorance of science, and B, I think the party's concern about the women's vote.
I want to get to the women's vote in a minute, but isn't that what this is revealing, is the crazy tortured position the Republicans have gotten themselves into over the rape exception? So you guys are right, and I think Erin is absolutely right. It's not intellectually consistent. What's intellectually consistent is to believe in the death penalty for abortion doctors and also to have no exceptions at all. Because obviously murder is a higher order crime than rape, and so if you think it's murder, it's just murder.
And on the pro-choice, and what's intellectually consistent is to not make exceptions in our mind for sex selection abortion or for, you know, that all of these things that seem morally questionable to a lot of pro-choice advocates, we can't draw those lines either.
Right, exactly. That seems fair. But I guess the question for me is, haven't the conservatives just then gotten themselves in further trouble? Because the one single victory or language victory that the pro-choice side has won over the last 10, 15 years is this rape exception, is keep forcing that down people's throats. It's like Bill Clinton used to use this. Almost every candidate has used this as the moral line. You can't possibly think that it's okay to deny abortion to someone who's been raped. So the Republicans have been forced to take on that position. And then over the last 10 years, they've come up with this ridiculous language, which has gotten them in ever more trouble, where they're trying to decide what's legitimate rape and what's consensual rape. But my question is, doesn't this come off of like the whole date rape era? Isn't this where this is coming from? I mean, why is what he's saying largely different from, say, what Katie Roifey said in her book about date rape?
Yes.
Probably. And I think people were pretty unhappy with Katie Roifey's argument back then, too. She didn't make the same biological argument, but it sort of stoked the same anger in people, right?
Right, that rape is just rape. I mean, I noticed when Shauna Pruitt, which I wrote about in Double X Factor, in Exo Jane, she is a woman who confessed to having had a baby after rape, which I haven't really seen before. Very few women have done that. And she wrote about her conflicted feelings around that. She very pointedly did not describe what happened to her. Mm-hmm. Exactly what the rape looked like or what happened, because I think she probably has gone down this road before and been subject to the same scrutiny, like, well, what were you doing? Was he your boyfriend? You know, was it date rape or was it really rape? And so I thought it was an incredibly smart decision on her part not to reveal what actually happened to her.
One point that I thought Erin made that was also very good was that the pro-choice movement, in an effort to make conservatives sympathize with women who want to have abortions, have focused on this rape and incest exception, even when that is not the common reason for women having abortions. It's a more sympathetic reason. It's a reason that, like, that many Republicans can be okay with. But in that, there's a problem. I think it's giving their side a lot more ammunition and a lot more leeway to say, well, okay, fine with that stuff, but not with regular abortions.
Yeah, it's like the perfect victim problem again. You can't just want to have an abortion for certain reasons. It has to be for this specific reason. And it can't just be rape. It has to be like
bad rape.
Bad rape.
And anyway, imagine what like a weird, sick world that leads to. Like if you can imagine a state which only has a rape exception, you know, what you'll have is a lot of young women claiming that they were raped, you know, and then people doubting whether they were raped or not.
Right.
And then it just creates a really like an air of sort of suspicion and awfulness.
Well,
around
our own Amanda Marcotte wrote a piece yesterday titled Rape Exceptions Don't Work. And a lot of Latin American countries ban abortion except for these exceptions. But these exceptions are ignored, or there's such a climate of intimidation that doctors are scared to perform the abortions. And there are many, many stories of young women who have been raped or have been victims of incest in Latin American countries that can't get the exception.
Yeah, the question of what this would look like in practical terms is a sort of terrifying one. And I want to read one more quote from Wilkie, the doctor, because this is like a stunning thing. Someone asked him, you know, if you get your way, we're going to go back to illegal abortions. And he goes, this time around, illegal abortions will be considerably safer than they were. People who do them have had a great deal of experience. Like the logic inherent in that is just nuts.
Yeah.
Like,
I was just going to say, it's almost as if they want to create a wink, wink, nod, nod situation. Like they want to be living in a country in which abortion is illegal, but they kind of want to have it both ways. So they want to create this little hole and they want to, you know, they want it to be okay to sort of climb through this little hole if you need to.
I'm just wondering if you guys actually have a real fear that there's a threat to abortion rights, or do you think a lot of this is political season? stuff.
You know, I'm amazed every political season. I grew up in a post Roe v. Wade era. I take abortion for granted. And I, every political season, am surprised anew by the vehemence with which people would like to eliminate abortion. I mean, it's true that the national polls show that to be an unpopular move, that largely the nation has stayed steadily in favor of first-term abortion, you know, in the majority for a very, very, very long time. You know, for maybe 40 or 50 years, that's been the steady American majority. And yet there is this very strong political push to have it illegal. So, you know, because they're so vehement, it just, it never dies. It doesn't go away. It doesn't wax and wane the way some other culture war issues. I mean, you see gay rights wanes, right? You feel like that movement against gay marriage is sort of lost, or they're losing. You have a clear sense they're losing, but you don't feel that way about abortion. Like, they never seem to be losing. No, they always seem to have the same vigor that they had 20 years ago.
I've just been surprised by how much, like, hatred there is surrounding it this time in particular. And maybe I'm just a little more attuned to it, and, you know, Twitter sort of unearths things more quickly and throws them in your face more quickly. But I don't think that there's an actual existential threat to it. But it's sort of like radicalizing me. And I think of myself as a pretty moderate person. And I'm like ready to, you know, climb on the barriers. I'm pretty upset.
Now, here's the caveat to that. This Aiken thing has revealed that the Republican Party will only go so far with this issue. I mean, that's the surprise right. that came out here. I don't want to talk too much about the politics, but the ABC News clip talked about, you know, how important the gender gap is for Republicans and how interested they are in winning the women's vote. And there's been a lot of pre-convention press about how Mitt Romney wants to portray himself as very warm and a family man and appeal more to women. And it seems like they immediately, instantaneously backed off this one. Like, they did not give him a second. It was like 1 second before Karl Rove cut off his funding. It's like they recognized very, very quickly that even Republican women were not going to be on board with this one. And maybe that's some kind of progress. You know, maybe that shows that people like Aiken are seriously not in the mainstream. It like allies him more with the whack job, you know, profit and not with the mainstream Republican Party.
I don't necessarily think it shows that he's not in the mainstream. I think it shows that they desperately want to win the White House. They're willing to sacrifice the majority in the Senate in order to do so by taking his funding and support away.
I think it shows they're not sure what the mainstream is anymore. There are people who are supposedly the adults running the shop, but then it's getting splintered in a way that is scary even to them. You know, he's not falling in line. He's not doing what's good for the party, and that's probably frightening for them.
Right, although they were willing last minute to sacrifice the Senate majority. That seems like a pretty big move, you know?
Right.
Okay, well, let's move on to our next topic. But before we do, I want to thank our sponsor, which this week is XX Audible. Audible is not a new sponsor for our loyal listeners. You've heard us mention this before. You can choose from 100,000 audiobooks and listen to them on practically any device, including the one you're listening to us right now. And for XX listeners who aren't Audible members already, you get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day trial. The special URL, which is audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, and it also includes a free subscription to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. The book I've been listening to, you know, we've mentioned a lot on this podcast, is Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. I've actually already read it, and in my mind, and we don't have time to discuss this, I was actually, someone brought up the idea of whether the characters were truly reprehensible. And I thought, no, I really enjoyed the book. But anyway, I'm going back and forth on that. So I decided to listen to the book a little bit and see if having her read it changed my mind. But that's our recommendation for these last waning days of summer. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is Paul Ryan, hot or not, to put it crudely. Do you guys like that my imitation of E? That was a good E imitation. Anyway, so I had not really looked at the shirtless photos of Paul Ryan before we started this podcast. I guess there's only one of them, right? There's not like a lot of pictures of shirtless Paul Ryan.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was even from before his P90X days.
P90X. See, that term wasn't that familiar to me. Now, before we get into this, I want to introduce Rachel Larimore, who's calling into our podcast this morning because she's in love with Paul Ryan, right?
I'm very excited about him being on the vice presidential ticket.
That's all you're going to get
us? We're not talking politics.
I am excited for lots of reasons.
Yes. One of them is the P90X workout. Now, Rachel, you're a devotee of the P90X workout?
Off and on, yes.
Really?
I have a short attention span, so I can do it for a few weeks, and then I get bored and go back to the gym.
This is the workout that Paul Ryan does
to have
the abs.
It's a 3-month program if you do it properly, and every night you do, or well, every day, you do a different workout. So one day, and they're generally like strength training one day and then like a cardio type thing the next. So one day you might do a lot of like pull-ups and push-ups and work your upper body, your back, and your chest. And then the next day you'll do like kickboxing or some plyometrics. And then the next day you'll do lots of squats. And the idea is muscle confusion, which means that your muscles never get comfortable so you don't plateau.
You sound exactly like Paul Ryan. It's like the Mormon body church or something. He said exactly those words.
We're all on the same page.
I know this is very popular in Congress, a very popular congressional workout, but is it only popular in Republican congressional circles or is it all the rage in Washington?
Doesn't Michelle, wasn't there some story about Michelle Obama doing it at one point?
I don't
know. A Politico story about P90X.
Okay.
So it's a Washington.
It crosses the...
I think it's a type A thing.
I'm amazed that people in Congress or Michelle Obama would have the time to do it because I come up with all kinds of excuses not to work out 6 or 7 days a week and I'm not in Congress.
Well, it did slightly depress me like when I read these stories about P90X. And then, you know, there's always the reference to Obama playing basketball and how fit all these guys are. I found myself yearning for the old Chicago boss days when, like, being a politician meant, like, sitting around, smoking cigars, drinking a lot and, you know, and getting fat, basically. It seemed slightly depressing to me that this is our model. A future politician is some kind of, like, perfected superhuman who not only is the busiest person on the planet but somehow has time to, you know, wake up at, I don't know when they wake up, at 5 o'clock and do this workout. Who published the shirt? List, Ryan.
TMZ.
It was
our
TMZ.
Nation's finest political investigative unit.
So it's not like a sort of scene off the yacht, right? It's not like a celebrity photo. He was just getting out of the pool with his wife and somehow.
But also there's an old picture floating around of him with his personal trainer that I believe he or his like people sent into Roll Call, maybe? Or no, Real Clear Politics. I can't remember, but like a legitimate political blog. This was like maybe 3 years ago to show off. I think he and Mitch Daniels were having some sort of like guns competition show off his guns.
Now, Rachel, has he long been a conservative girl crush? Like, has Paul Ryan been sort of a secret crush for a long time?
He kind of burst onto my consciousness in 2010. And to be honest, I thought he was handsome with the blue eyes, but I was kind of more excited about his budget plan. So.
You're really bringing the conversation to a level.
I mean, he's very handsome, but I guess I wasn't aware of him very much until he started making headlines.
I think it's a hot wonk thing. I mean, I think it's something like that. I think you're supposed to be excited about both his P90X, you know, physique and his budget plan. I think that's how it works. He's like the new polished nerd.
I think that was Romney's hope when he put him on the ticket.
Right. Yeah, that was his other ploy to win the women vote. So now the two questions that came up with Romney's physique, one was, why are we talking about this and laughing? And imagine if, like, in the sports podcast, they were talking about Michelle Bachmann this way, would we be horrified and insulted? Why is it okay for us to talk about his chest?
You know, we always have these conversations, and then we always question whether we should have these conversations. To me, it's kind of reminiscent about going back to 4 years ago, as much as I would like to forget that election. I mean, we talked about Sarah Palin's clothes and her shoes and whether she was hot. So I think it's probably just human nature, and we're going to do it, just like even though many of us who are very smart and educated and read the newspaper might like to take 10 minutes and go look at TMZ in our coffee break. So I think it's just human nature.
I would like someone to go back, because Andrea Pizer from the New York Post called this the year of the man slut. And I would like someone to go back and see how exactly people talked about the Kennedy or JFK. Like, was it acceptable to discuss the fact that he was very good looking? Or was that something that wasn't really mentioned in newspapers and you just kind of knew it, but it wasn't worthy of official comment and mention in the pre-blog era? I'm just not sure about that.
I think we talked about it with Obama.
Yeah, but I'm sure the Kennedys were described as handsome, which is probably a more dignified way of alluding to that than, like, you know, talking about his six pack and, like, you know, searching the internet for naked pictures. But, like, I think that politicians have always been
celebrities.
Yeah, they're described in physical terms. Like, Kennedy was handsome. I'm sure that made its way into the press reports.
You know? And I'm sure he intentionally had himself photographed.
How many stories and studies have there been saying that, you know, once the TV era began, you know, unattractive politicians like Richard Nixon have no chance.
Right. But in the 60s, people would have Googled, if there were Google, people would have Googled, you know, JFK handsome. They wouldn't have Googled JFK shirtless, you know, which was the second most Googled. I think budget plan was maybe sixth or seventh.
Conversation.
Historical
have,
Googling. Yeah.
Historical Googling.
Well, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say I do not find him to be handsome. And I am willing to find a Republican handsome. In fact, I kind of have an Ed Harris thing for that idiot Steve King. But but I don't think he's – I don't get it.
I agree. He has nice eyes, and he looks like a dork.
Yeah.
But not like – not the kind of dork I like.
Yeah. I like that. He has nice eyes, but he looks like a dork. That's actually a
– Well, I think that's his appeal, right?
Right.
Noreen wrote a very good column, funny column, about Paul Ryan's been criticized for all of his clothes being too big. And Noreen made an argument for why this is a good thing.
Right. So GQ and the New York Times style columnists have all said, Paul Ryan, you're buying the wrong size suit. You need to get it tailored. You're wearing baggy clothes. You're not doing yourself any favors. And I sort of think he is. You know, you don't want to have a guy who's a little too slick on the political rally. It's sort of endearing. You know, he's like your big brother who just, you know, doesn't care that much about fashion. And if he, you know, pays a little too much attention to his appearance, all of a sudden he's vain. All of a sudden, he's a little less relatable, and the Romney ticket certainly doesn't need more charges of unrelatability, I think.
A good example of that is that Congressman Aaron Schock, who is he also from Wisconsin?
Who's Aaron Schock?
He's a Republican congressman who is also very fit, but he's very into clothes. And I think, I don't know which men's magazine, but he's definitely had spreads in men's magazines with the skinny ties and the skinny pants. And it was bad for his image.
Right. You don't want that John Edwards, like, I'm, you know, that
pretty boy.
Yeah, that pretty boy. And then somebody will unearth his Barney's receipt from Georgetown when he snuck in, or his Taylor receipt or whatever. That's just embarrassing, particularly for a Republican. The last thing I want to say about this is Maureen Dowd's column. I feel like as the campaign goes on, this is going to become a running theme, which is her phrase was the cutest package that cruelty ever came in. The idea of this, you know, pretty boy budget slasher, like, don't be fooled by those pretty blue eyes. He's about to take your social welfare away, kind of trope about Paul Ryan is going to live on.
And to tie it back to our earlier conversation, your right to choose, he's one of the strongest anti-abortion proponents in Congress.
Right.
So, you know, women might think he's hot, but there's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel, for joining us for this segment.
Thank you for having me.
So now let's move on to our final topic, which is the Augusta Club's decision to offer a membership for the first time ever to two women. And the two women they chose were former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and businesswoman Darla Moore. I am trying to figure out why on earth we should care about this. I mean, I just find it utterly preposterous. If someone gave me that green jacket, I would, like, you know, cut it up, toss it away, like, put on a play with it. You know, it's fit for, like, a Wes Anderson movie, but not for any real life as any of us live it. I don't actually feel that Condi Rice is, like, some big traitor. I think, you know, I would give them the middle finger if they offered it to me, but it's okay for her to do it. Do you guys feel differently? Were you moved in any way by this?
Well, first of all, they wouldn't offer it to you. I think, like, who they chose was very carefully rolled out.
But they still need a Jew. Like, they have a black woman. They have, like, a regular white woman. You know, they need, like, a couple of more, and then that's it. The doors are closed.
Right. Right. Well, but Condoleezza Rice, like, spoke out about a year ago. Someone asked her, you know, are you angry about Augusta not letting in women? And she sort of towed the party line on that. She said she doesn't feel like they need to feel obligated to admit women. She felt differently, you know, until 1990, they didn't admit African Americans. And she said that was a different thing. But she was totally fine with them excluding women because there are, you know, women's organizations and men's organizations in this world. So she was the perfect person for them to admit. She was on board with their whole philosophy surrounding it.
Right.
But would I have given back the jacket? No.
Do you play golf?
No, I don't play golf.
What do I know?
I hate golf.
Okay, this is the argument that Katie Waldman made, and I tend to agree with her. In the larger scheme of things, I don't care. I mean, I think that's what you were saying, Hannah. Like, can we really get worked up about this, and can we really care about Augusta at all? Eh. But if we want the organization to change, the club to change, Katie wrote, you know, it will never be able to do what we wanted to do, which is embrace female members without actual female members to embrace. So unless they offer and people say yes, then it's never going to change. And if this is like a small evolution, a small step, like, don't we take those?
I just feel like if we care and if we accord this front page New York Times status, which it was given, then we are somehow conceding the fact that the Augusta Club and such clubs have any importance in America anymore. It's like not 1953. Like, I don't care whether the Augusta Club does one thing or does another thing. It's like a golf club. I just don't understand why that's worthy of front page news, except for in the 90s, the New York Times was on a high horse about it and ran these stories largely propelled by Howell Raines, who was obsessed with this story, you know, every day. Like, are you going to give it to a woman? Are you going to give it to him? And I actually kind of like that because you know it matters to Howell Raines. Like, you know, if you sort of come from that culture and understand those people and that has kind of a large web of significance for you, then I like that fight. Like, Howell Raines versus the Augusta Club, I can get behind and sort of follow the news. But other than that, it just seems like I don't
care.
Why?
Doesn't symbolism matter? I mean, that's, you know.
But why are we saying it's an important symbol anymore? Like, you know, like, saying that an exclusive golf club is like the apogee of American culture, it's not.
It's certainly not. But would, in 1990, when they invited the first black member, you would also say like that wasn't a worthy news story or a...
I just say it's shame and embarrassment. And the story should read like how the Augusta Club, shouldn't they be embarrassed that it took them until 1990 to
admit a black
member?
I don't think they should be getting credit for this. I mean, I don't think it's some like progressive move, but it is a tiny step. And if you cared about golf, or for instance, if I was shocked when I was reading a Reuters story to see that, you know, they don't release all of their members, but I guess it's been confirmed that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are members. Those are people we expect, you know, better from.
Right.
And who we revere for their philanthropy and for their politics. And so I kind of do think it matters. Again, like not in a huge, larger sense, like it's going to change the country, but
it's an old boys club.
Yeah. And it's like one little crack in it.
Yeah.
I mean, reading these quotes about we're not going to admit women, you know, at the point of a bayonet.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of understood that, right? Like what happened is if you missed your moment and didn't subtly admit women in the usual way, then it became this political pressure, largely, as I said, you know, propelled by the New York Times. And then you were like, screw you, you know, I'm not going to do it. And now suddenly it's 2012 and you find yourself in this ridiculous position. So you sort of see what happened to them. But reading those old quotes, I just felt like these people are not of our time. You know, there was definitely a little part of me that felt some like first wave feminist rage when I read these quotes. But then there was another part of me that thought, like, these guys are dinosaurs. Like, who talks
except
like this?
Except that they're not, if it's Bill Gates. I mean, have you ever been to the Greenbrier? It's like,
yes.
It's just like this sad. Once. It's not nice anymore. It's not fancy. It's like, it's sad. I mean, it's certainly of another era, but I still think they represent something bad.
Who is going to join Augusta in like 25 years? Like, I don't picture people like getting on a
waiting
list.
You can't picture like Mark Zuckerberg wanting
right.
to get his green jacket.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think people grow up and they become 40 instead of 30 and they want some sort of like, they want to be able to show in some way like the prestige that they've
I think achieved. They're going to be different symbols of prestige. I think
there might be, but they'll be equally gross.
Right. But there will be people who want to join it, but I don't think they will be sort of like the best and brightest. And I don't think that's been the case for a long time with it.
A funny way with Augusta, I felt like it had really missed its moment because golf clubs today are almost they are a sort of quiet little bastion of male bonding in my very limited experience with golf clubs and the people I know who join them in Maryland and around D.C. It's like this is a moment where like the universal status of joining a golf club is not what the golf club is about. It's like, you know, one of the few places men can get together and nobody stares at them or thinks it's really embarrassing and there's a dudes club and you can have a beer in the middle of the day and that's okay. And I think that's almost what golf clubs should be about. But it's like the Augusta Club is sort of fighting a battle that's 40 years old.
The Augusta Club, though, also does have a private profile, but it also has a public profile because I don't care about golf. But it, you know, it hosts the Masters, which is one of the biggest golf tournaments of the year, which is on network television and with corporate sponsors. So it does have some sort of public role / accountability.
And golf is ever popular. I mean, we may not care about golf, but lots and lots of people care about golf. I have
people to
say, the moment that did get me was when they failed to offer membership to Ginni Rometty, who is the new CEO of IBM. That I thought was incredibly obnoxious. So they systematically offer membership to whoever is the current CEO of IBM, and she's a woman, and they didn't offer her membership. That seems to me like above and beyond obnoxious. And I think it's unclear what the real story is behind that.
I agree. Because that was just in April. So, like, I don't think some huge ideological shift could have happened between then and now. And that would have been such a natural way for them to, like, have broken this boundary without even much, they wouldn't have even had to really put out a statement about it.
Right. But the women they selected were so carefully selected to fit within their ideology. You know, like, this woman, Darla Moore, was in 1997, was on the cover of Fortune magazine as, like, the toughest person in business, you know? And she just sounds like a tough broad who, like, will fit right in the clubhouse. And Condoleezza Rice has totally backed their whole philosophy. You know, they probably didn't think this woman was going to fit in.
I'm curious about what the women's locker room situation is going to be like. Well, I'm sure the men's locker room is this, like, castle of
Condoleezza Rice changing in a linen closet.
You're right, exactly.
It's going to be like Condi and Darla, like, staring at each other like, hey, hey.
They're probably never going to play there. Right. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that Condoleezza Rice, what she said, what Noreen was referring to earlier, is right? That, like, it's fine for there to be men's clubs and women's clubs? Not necessarily golf clubs, but just, like, in general.
It's legal. It's not like a black club and a white club. Do I think it's fine? I mean, we run a women's magazine, right? Shouldn't we think that's fine?
I think it's fine if there are no bright lines. Like, it's like, okay, this is a women's club, but, like, if you really, really, really want to be in it, sure, guy, you can be in it, you know? And probably there won't be a lot of men who do, you know? I think it's fine in that sense, if it's just sort of, like, about building community. But I think when you make it about exclusion, that's something different.
I grew up actually going to a Jewish country club in Youngstown, Ohio. That was, like, not fancy. It was probably, like, $500 a year. But still, it was, for a long time, you know, Jews only. And mm-hmm. then they changed the membership. I don't want to say that I know all of these things for sure, so I'm not going to name the club. But, like, I believe that they changed the membership rules so that you didn't have to necessarily be Jewish, but you had to, like, give a certain amount of money to a local synagogue or to the Jewish Community Center or some sort of Jewish organization to be allowed in. Through the years, that's changed too, and now it's totally open. But that always, you know, seemed distasteful to me as a kid. But those things exist all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Did you refuse to go?
No. I mean, it was distasteful until I wanted to go to the pool. Right. I wasn't like a conscientious objector kind of kid.
Right.
But I wouldn't join one now.
All right. Well, let's move on to our recommendations. I guess I will go first today. Why not? Because we were talking about stuffy clubs. I feel like my recommendation is right up the stuffy club alley. Having just come back from vacation, I had a really nice vacation in Barcelona. I read a great book called Seating Arrangements by Maggie Shipstead. The central character is this patriarch straight out of the Augusta Club who is, in fact, obsessed with getting into clubs. That's his lifetime, you know, many-year obsession. And he's really wonderfully drawn. And he lives in a family of girls, daughters, and his wife. And it's all takes place over the course of a wedding weekend and his own misbehaving and grasping. And it's really quite excellent. And as the summer is waning, this should be the last summer book that you slip in there. I really enjoyed it.
So I was going to do a paired recommendation. So Seating Arrangements is set in Maine. I'd call it a beach read, right, Hannah?
It's oh, sort of totally a beach read.
Yeah.
Totally.
So I actually, by sheer coincidence, read two beach reads set in Maine. And the other one, it's called Maine by J. Courtney Sullivan. And the family in Seating Arrangements is a WASP clan, and this is an Irish Catholic clan. And it's sort of a similar thing in that it's focused around a bunch of women and it's very sharply observed. But it's sort of wonderful to read them as a pairing and to sort of look at the ways that these clannish families are described by these two young women who both, I think, emerged out of those traditions and sort of hold them at arm's length. So,
excellent.
Highbrow beach reads.
Allison.
Okay, well, mine also comes out of vacation, but it's not a book. I went to the Berkshires for a week, and ever since I was a little kid reading New York Magazine in the bathtub in Ohio, I'd wanted to go to Jacob's Pillow. So we went, and it's kind of amazing. Have you guys ever been?
What's
no.
Jacob's Pillow?
Oh, I'm sorry. Jacob's Pillow is a dance festival in the Berkshires. It's an all-summer. It's like a commune, essentially. It looks like a commune. It's this beautiful, I don't know how many acre plot of land with cabins for volunteers and staff. And, you know, there's a gorgeous outdoor stage that looks out over the mountains and you can watch a performance at night as the sun sets. There are indoor theaters. It feels out of another era. It's sort of the people who are there sort of feel like out of a Woody Allen movie. It's very like East Coast, but it made me want to give it all up and go volunteer for the summer at a dance camp. And I actually didn't even like the performance that we saw, but it's so gorgeous. It's just so gorgeous. So if anyone's ever out that way in the summertime, check it out.
Well, dance camp sounds a lot better than P90X to me.
Hey, Hannah, can we do a South by Southwest plug?
Yes, go ahead.
So the Double X Gab Fest wants to go to South by Southwest. So Hannah and I and Alyssa Rosenberg, who is a Double X culture blogger, and a special guest, Jenny Connor, who is an executive producer of HBO's Girls, have submitted a panel for your consideration at South by Southwest. But we need you to vote us into South by Southwest. So we will have a link on our GabFest page and our Facebook page where you can register and vote and say that you want to see us do a live GabFest at South by Southwest. Vote early and often.
Before we go today, I just want to say that my new book, The End of Men, is coming out on September 11th, and Slate is sponsoring an event in New York. So for any of you podcast listeners who live in New York, there are actually very few tickets left, so I'm reluctant to spread this, but you can go on my website, hannahrosen.com, which should be up today, actually, or on Slate, it was announced, and buy tickets that way, and I think you get a discount on the book, but David and I will have a discussion slash argument slash debate on stage. We're also doing the same thing in Washington, D.C. the night before at 6th and I, so please come, listeners. And my website is not quite up, but it will be any minute, but it's hannahrosen.com. And, you know, there's events in Boston, there's events in Louisville and San Francisco and LA and lots of different places. So I really, really look forward to meeting podcast listeners. They are our favorite fans. They're the most loyal and intimate, and we love to meet them wherever we go. So please do stop by and introduce yourself if you come to any of my events. Would love to meet you. Thank you all for joining us again today. Thank you to Abdullah Rufus for engineering and producing this podcast, to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. And as always, please log on to our XX Facebook page and let us know what you'd like for us to talk about. And we will see you in a couple of weeks.